Hello, this is Peter Fisher, and this is Sequence 2, Episode 3 of the Fisher Files. And today I'm going to talk about getting a postdoc and being a postdoc.
Because I can't be around you and not be with you if you refuse to come with me. I'll go it alone.
So I hope all of you enjoyed Howell last week. I spent the time driving across South Dakota and Minnesota with my family, which was just wonderful. It's quite an amazing area, the upper plains and the prairie, and I suggest you visit it if you get a chance. So today I'm going to talk about getting a postdoc and being a postdoc, and this is part of a little series of three about different stages in your career. I'm broadcasting today from Danahy Park at a soccer match, and just my daughter's at a kiddie party, and rather than stay there, I thought I'd come out here and watch some soccer and talk to you. So anyway, we'll kind of pick this up where the last podcast left off, which was you've written your thesis, or you're starting to write your thesis, and about that time where you're typically, well, if you do it my way, 6 to 9 months out, that's a good time to begin slowly looking for a job. Now, as I've mentioned, I'm a big believer in starting things very early and going about them slowly. So the first thing you're really going to want to think about as you undertake this is, you know, what you're going to want to do with your life. Remember, one of the underlying themes of these podcasts is connecting your big life goals with the little daily tasks, and certainly your job to a huge extent defines what your little daily tasks are. And whether you choose to remain in academics or go into some other area is one of the largest decisions you're going to make, and there is some thought. Some people don't think about it at all, and they just know what they want to do. There's nothing wrong with that, but I think at least at the stage where you're beginning to write your thesis, it's a good idea to talk to your thesis advisor, talk to people maybe a little bit outside your field, and try to get their perspectives on it. There are some myths. There's the myth that, you know, you can go to Wall Street and make a zillion dollars, and that is, you know, largely true. But remember, as a quantitative analyst on Wall Street, you're not part of the core operation of whatever bank or financial institution you'd be a part of. And a good guideline for getting a job that you want to have a future is to make sure that what your position is part of the central mission of the organization, and not something that can be easily shed in the time of economic downturn. So the other thing to think about, the other myth, is that industry pays much more. Now, in terms of dollars, that's probably in general too. It's true. It's probably, you know, between 20 and maybe 50% more, depending on where you are and what you're doing. But you have to look at the whole cost. One of the good things about being a postdoc or staying in academics is, in academics, we all understand that people's time is really their own, and to a large extent, people are free to organize how they work the way they want. I don't know of any university or physics lab that has core hours or requires people to punch a clock. I mean, clearly you're going to have responsibilities that you'll need to meet, and there'll be meetings, and you'll have to show up at certain times. But in terms of having to be in the office at your desk and available between 8 and 5, I just don't know of any place that requires that the way most businesses do. So that's one thing to think about. Another thing that's not inconsequential is our manner of dress. Unless I'm feeling differently, I go to work in blue jeans and a short sleeve shirt. During the summer, I wear sandals with no socks. And, you know, if anyone doesn't like that, that's too bad. And again, I've never heard of anyone being told that they had to dress differently. I'm sure people have, but it's a pretty extreme thing. Whereas, you know, if you're in business, there is a dress code, and, you know, typically going through 2-3 suits a year is going to be a few thousand dollars. Also, where you live. Depending on where you live, it can be quite a bit cheaper in academics, and certainly at the faculty level, there is help with housing. Most labs will provide some limited housing. But more to the point, in academics, we don't expect a certain level of accommodation in our homes, in that entertaining people is something we do for pleasure, typically in restaurants. We're not obligated to have people into our homes the way you would be if you're in a business where you're trying to make partner, or an independent operator where entertainment, you know, in your home is a key thing. So keep all of those things in mind. You've got to be able to look at the whole picture about what your life is going to be like, and not just the final dollar amount. Now, I'm not saying that should not be taken as advice not to go into industry. I think there are many wonderful things that you can do in industry, and it's something to certainly consider. Just be sure to look at the whole picture. Now, one obvious place to start is the back pages of Physics Today. And I remember in 1988, I think, I was going through the back pages of Physics Today, and I sent off a letter to 3 or 4 of the promising-looking places for junior faculty positions. And in the same issue, there was an article by Phil Anderson about how to find a job. Which I read, and he basically said, look, you're going to get a job through your advisor, through his personal contacts. Don't bother with the ads in the back of Physics Today. Those jobs are already taken or are not worth having. You know, sort of typical Phil Anderson. As it turned out, one of those ads was for Johns Hopkins University for a junior faculty position, which I eventually got. And so I did get a faculty position by looking in the back of Physics Today. So it's a good place to start, just to get a sense of what the market is, what groups are working on, just to kind of, it's a baby step to kind of getting an assessment of the field. Clearly, your advisor, your collaborators, if you're part of a big experiment, other people in the group, are going to be a tremendous resource, and I would say a lot of people get their first postdocs just by, you know, being known by other people and through personal recommendation. But it's still good to look around on the web and in the back of Physics Today, especially if you're interested in changing field a little bit, which I'll come back to later. Now, one of the very key things in contacting someone is going to be your CV. And I think all of you probably know what your CV should look like. There's kind of a first page with a lot of factual information, positions held, educational history, references, marital status, address, phone number. Be sure all those things are on there. Don't assume that people will just go to Spires and find you, or, you know, whatever your discipline uses. Your CV should be complete, so it should include all of your publications, even if you're on an experiment like Babar that has a zillion publications. Probably you didn't contribute to many of them, but you can call those out and put those under primary publications. You know, put on all your all your conference talks, seminars given, and so on. I would advise against putting collaboration talks. You know, these days those can be bigger than conference talks, but it, to me, just looks a little bit silly. Remember, the primary purpose of your CV is to provide factual information, and the more intangible information should be provided in a cover letter. So your CV should just be a standard factual thing of arbitrary length. For the cover letter, this is, in some cases, really the very first contact you're going to have with someone. So my advice is, you know, write a separate cover letter for each job. Start by explaining a little bit about who you are. So, you know, I'm so-and-so, I've been working at CDF for 4 years and analyzing data, looking for single top quark production. Second paragraph, how you heard about the job and why you're interested. And, you know, that should really only be three, four sentences, maybe five sentences. But tell them up front why you're interested. And then a concluding paragraph about, you know, I'd like to apply for the position and come visit. Please contact me at your earliest convenience. The main thing, I think, is you really want this to fit on a page. Because if this is going to a search committee or somebody who's looking through many, many applications, it's reading anything more than that can be daunting. And at this point, you really don't have a lot to say to that person, and you just want to get it in their mind quickly. You'll want to do this even if it's somebody you casually meet, for example, in the CERN cafeteria. And they mention they have a postdoc and say, oh, you should apply. Write a cover letter, send it to them by email along with your CV. You know, act quickly. Generally, it's fairly easy to find good postdocs. There's really seems to always be a very strong demand for getting a postdoc. When you go to interview, you'll give a job talk. The main thing about giving a job talk, and it may be the first time that you actually give an hour-long seminar, is what you talk about should be interesting. You're going to be giving it to a pretty mixed group of people, probably, if it's at a university, and people from undergraduates to senior faculty. And you should make sure there's something for everyone in your job talk. Don't feel compelled to show every single detail of what you've done. There's this attitude that some people have that they're being dishonest if they don't explain everything. The main thing you should do is number one, make it clear what your role in the work was. And number two, make sure that it's interesting and engaging. No matter how boring you think about it, there's a phase you go through in writing your thesis where you just think your topic is murderously dull and everybody knows about it and nobody cares. That's almost always false. So your job talk should really start out with, you know, why do you care about this? And should go on to say, you know, why you care about it and what you've been doing. You'll want to mention, you know, your technical skills that you've developed in doing this. And the talk is really about you. It's very different than an invited seminar, for example, at a university where you're not looking for a job and kind of speaking on behalf of your experiment, and very different than a conference talk where you are really speaking on behalf of the experiment. Your job talks about you, and you should talk about what you've done. When you're interviewing, you should feel free to ask any questions that you think are important. People are never put off by being asked questions. And it's very important that you get a really clear idea in the day or two that you'll be visiting. You should be sure to try to talk to people at all levels, because very frequently there may be serious problems in a group that the faculty is really unaware of, that you will only hear from the students and other postdocs. So be sure to try to arrange some time alone with the students and other postdocs and ask them what their lives are like, because their lives will be your life should you get the job. Always, 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 after you visit a place, send a thank you note. And when you leave and have some parting words with your host, be sure to leave your status in some clear position, as in, you'll get back to me in a couple weeks, or I'll let you know if they make you an offer. And also try to honestly indicate to them your level of interest. If it's really something that you don't think you're going to be interested in, it's not a bad idea to kind of let them know that. That might shape their thinking a little bit and make it easier for you to say no later on. If you're very interested, absolutely tell them. Feel like if they offered you a job, you'd take it. Kind of let them know that. Be a little circumspect, but it's really just very good to be really honest about what your feelings are. Should you get an offer, you'll be given some time to let them know, typically between a week or a month. And there's probably a little scope for negotiation about moving costs. Postdocs typically don't get a startup fund, but that may be true. That's really your chance to nail everything down. And a good thing to do is when you're considering someone's offer, send them an email saying, thank you very much for the offer. I understand that. And then, either as a bullet list or just a narrative, let them know what your understanding about the details of the position are. And really be very careful to think it through, especially if you're having to relocate a long distance. What's the start date? Is it compatible with when your thesis will be done? What are your responsibilities? It could be, these days with LHC starting, that a group might want you to start at the home institution for a few months and then move to CERN. How flexible are dates for that? Could the situation change? I mean, what you really don't want to have happen is that you take a postdoc to work at CMS and be based at CERN, and then you get to wherever you are, and they say, well, you're not going to CERN, we've changed our plans. You want to make it explicit what your expectations are before you take the job. There's absolutely nothing wrong with doing this. So if there are moving costs and things involved, you don't think it's sufficient, be sure to let them know. If they can't do anything more, then they can't do anything more, but it certainly is something that you should ask about. So now, being a postdoc, I kind of look at a career in the three stages: graduate student, postdoc, faculty member, or permanent researcher, as indicative of three different things. A graduate student, you really are out to demonstrate that you are able to complete a piece of work, which is your thesis, and have mastery over some area of your field, and acquire some set of technical skills that you can build on. And generally, my feeling is, the guy scored a goal. That was beautiful. Oh, and he just did two backflips in a row. I know a student is ready to graduate when, during the time I meet with them and we go over things, it's just obvious they think I'm full of shit and don't know what I'm talking about. You know, that's kind of when you know. As a postdoc, what you really need to demonstrate to advance in the field is that you could undertake a major element of your group's program and bring it through to fruition. And that includes managing students, perhaps another postdoc, making it clear what resources are needed, expending those resources in a responsible way, representing your work within a collaboration or within your community, and that the postdoc time is the time that you really develop from a student who is really dependent on others for advice and guidance and resources to someone who can really operate autonomously. And I think this view is true, whether it's a large experiment or a single investigator type experiment. It's really about you coming into your own. So obviously when you're looking for a job, you're going to want to make sure that doing that is possible, and that you're not just going to be a slavey. So in terms of being a postdoc, sort of the main thing you have to do is carve out in whatever project you're working on what your part of it's going to be. Now, this doesn't mean that you draw a dotted line around something and growl at anyone who isn't part of your group who tries to come inside that dotted line. In fact, unless you work very, very hard or are very, very lucky, that's a prescription for disaster. Because these days, particularly in high-energy physics, but I think in all physics, you're really going to need to collaborate. And so you need to define what it is you want to achieve and the scope of your project, and then reach that goal by collaborating and helping people as much as possible. I know this sounds contradictory, but certainly at the faculty level, it's what I really look for. And certainly what my field doesn't need are any more people who think they can do everything by themselves by staying up all night and working weekends. It's just nutty. So I'm now kind of talking specifically about high energy physics, where you'll be working most likely in at least a collaboration of 20 or so people. What you need to do when you start is spend some time, a month, mainly listening and seeing how things work. And I think this is probably good advice no matter what the field is, but there's a system, a way the collaboration operates, or the way the field operates, and you need to understand that before you try to make your move. Inevitably, there are going to be conflicts. It's kind of complicated for me with postdocs because let me just put it on the table. My view is that once somebody is a postdoc, they're kind of after that level, after you've got your PhD, in my view, everybody's kind of equal. There are people who are better than other people, people who have different technical skills, people who know more, people who have achieved a lot. But in terms of the way I react to people, it's the same whether they're a senior professor or a postdoc. To me, they're just a colleague. And, I don't see, any difference in what they should or should not be doing. Now, different people have different views. And one thing that you want to be a little bit circumspect about is taking a postdoc with where your immediate supervisor is a junior faculty member. I'm not saying this is a bad idea, because certainly the junior faculty are the ones who frequently have the most interesting and exciting ideas. But they're also in kind of the same position as the postdoc working with them, in that to be promoted, they have to be seen as the ones who carried out a certain piece of work. And so there have been, not at MIT, but at other places, a lot of kind of fighting over credit grabbing. That's going to happen. And I think the best thing to do is to talk about it beforehand, because my experience has been that there's always enough credit to go around. It never comes up, did this person do that, or did their postdoc do it? It's much more, how was guidance given? Was there support? Was there synergy? Was there a nice mix of abilities, rather than, did this person do it or did that person do it? So just be aware that you want to make sure that's not going to be something that's a big problem. What I should say about being a postdoc is that certainly in my view, I was only a postdoc for a year and a half, but certainly in my view, it's a really good time in your career, because there is just this wonderful kind of lack of arbitrary responsibility. You're not burdened with teaching, you're not burdened with committee work. You can undertake those things, but it's a really, nice time where you can really drill in and work on something. It's a time I really didn't have, so maybe I'm memorializing it more than it should be. As a postdoc, you want, another time you can switch out of physics is, after a postdoc. That's actually probably a good time. You do want to be aware that there's kind of a certain shelf life. And so when you're looking for your postdoc, you want to be really working on something that's going to come to fruition in the next couple of years, which is tough these days, but very doable. So those are my thoughts. The main thing is, as always, start well in advance and think about it a lot. Talk to a lot of people. And really try to choose something that you're really interested in and passionate about, rather than something that's safe or easy for you or something. It's a time where you can really excel, and you want to be excelling at something that you really believe in. So for this week's Mind Feed, there's a pretty interesting paper in Physical Review's Letters that actually popped up on Physical Review Focus, and that's about a recent calculation in Japan about the internuclear force. So this needs some history. Nuclei are composed of protons and neutrons that are bound together to form something similar to an atom. They've got shells and levels and things, although it's much more complicated because the strong interaction is so strong, and you have isospin plus 1/2 and minus 1/2 objects. But it's similar to an atom with levels and so on. And so there's a force or an interaction between nucleons that has a range of a few Fermis. But also, unlike the Coulomb interaction, if you get too close, there's a very strong repulsive interaction between nucleons. And this keeps nucleons from just collapsing into very tiny objects. So the internuclear force has to look like something that has a very high, very large repulsive force at something at ranges of less than like a quarter Fermi, and then an attractive force between like a quarter Fermi out to a few Fermis, and then a long tail that's weakly repulsive and asymptotically going down to zero. In the 1930s, Yakawa came up with a picture of nuclear binding by one pion exchange, and postulated a potential of the form of, you know, e to the minus m times r divided by r. So at large distances, that diminishes rapidly, so it's not infinite range like Coulomb. And at short distances, it becomes very strongly repulsive. So it's kind of a phenomenological thing. And through the course of time, since there were no analytic solutions to QCD, various nuclear potentials were created, kind of inspired by scattering data. The ones I remember from my time at Paul Scherrer Institute were the Paris potential and the Bond potential. And these were phenomenological, which is nice. They're based on scattering data and vector meson dominance, I guess. Well, probably vector meson dominance isn't right. It's just that at long distances it was dominated by one pion exchange, and then as you got close you could exchange rhos, omegas, and sigma. Starting about maybe 25 years ago at this point, there was the idea that you could numerically solve QCD on a computer by defining lattice points on a four-dimensional grid, three spatial dimensions and one time dimension, and then just, you know, brute force solving the QCD equations of motion, quantum mechanical equations of motion. And there are all kinds of problems. If you do it on a grid, you know, it's the number of grid points is whatever to the fourth power, and then at each grid point you've got to calculate, you know, wave functions and exchanges of a couple of gluons, which actually happens on the lines connecting the points. Anyway, it's a pretty tough calculation. And when I first heard about it in the 1980s, I was intrigued about it. I almost went to work with a guy named Jeffrey Fox, who was doing it at Caltech. And there were people who were building custom computers to do this. And it turned out the whole thing was just much, much harder than anybody believed. And it's only been in the last few years that lattice calculations have gotten good enough to make predictions that have been used in analysis of experimental data. Certainly the recent Babar results all now use lattice calculations for B meson form factors. The paper I'm mentioning in PRL is the first calculation, first realistic calculation of the nuclear potential using a Blue Gene supercomputer, which is very similar to John Negley's at MIT's, and they've calculated a potential that seems to be quite accurate, with it seems very little caveats or very few assumptions. So this is really kind of interesting that you know, even after the Nobel Prize was awarded for the creation of the QCD Lagrangian that describes the strong interaction, just now the computing is getting to the stage where actually meaningful predictions can be made. And it looks like now that they have this and the other results, that the field is kind of poised to explode and start being able to explain a lot of other new things. So I think this, see the last part of this podcast, but if you're, you know, really interested in something that's hot, I think lattice QCD might really be exploding in the next few years. So that's it for this week. Next week we'll talk about the next step, which is your first junior faculty appointment, and go on from there. The other thing I should mention is we're going to have some help with the web page and some other things that will hopefully make things a little bit easier and nicer, as well as getting the Gun One podcast back available. So, as usual, I'd like to thank Bonna Newman and Homer Reed from Rest for getting me started in this, and Maynard Galinas and Sean Thompson at the LNS Computational Facilities for helping with disk space and getting things set up, and Sheila and John Marston for all the work on the webpage and production help. And I'd also like to thank Terry Yu for her comments, and I encourage the rest of you to send comments. And I'm thinking about what sequence 3 is going to be about, and I'd really like to get some other voices into this. You can do it by phone, you can come by, but I think it'd be really good to hear from someone besides me. So have a good week, and enjoy your work and research in Cambridge or wherever you are. Kolono pelekani he ho olo heke kui ni o palani e lava e kapua iluna e no kapa ake a he maa kua mai kapua nei he o kalani ka vika he no ala he a he a he a he a he a he a aina mai kapua na he a kalani ka vika he no ala aina mai kapua I'm gonna make it.